Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Hello, everyone. My name is Matthias Koeniger-Kibuji. I'm associate professor in the Department of Government and Department of International Relations here at LSE. It's my pleasure to welcome you all to this LSE Festival event, to people here in the room, but also those who are following the event online. So the topic for today is how can countries prepare for the next global health crisis? Self-explanatory title, but you might also be wondering why are they not already preparing a lot for the next health crisis, where 20, 25 million excess deaths due to COVID, not enough to inject some urgency into pandemic preparation. Well, this is one of the aspects we will be discussing today. Are countries also doing enough and what should they be doing more? So this event is a collaboration between scholars from different departments here at LSE, all interested in global health, under the sort of general umbrella of the LSE Global Health Initiative. This is a multidisciplinary and interdepartmental networks of researchers interested in global health. So it has a website, it has a blog, also a mailing list. Please feel free to look at the website and register for the mailing list. You have to put in the full name, Global Health Initiative. I think if you only put in Global Health, you end up on the webpage of a different initiative, which is great as well, but it's not based on the interdepartmental research that supports this event. So a couple of practical points. Please put your mobile phones on silent. You can keep them on if you like to tweet, for instance, about the event, but please without volumes. If you hear the fire alarm, please, gather outside. There is a fire assembly point just opposite the Lincoln's Inn entrance of the of this building. This event is being recorded and might be the topic of a podcast in the future. Mm-hmm. So we will have the speakers, which I'm going to introduce in a minute, talking for 8 to 10 minutes each, and then we will have time for questions and answers. So obviously from the audience in the room, but also from people who are following us online. So in your course, after the first round of interventions by the speakers, I will also invite people online to ask questions, and they will be then relate to me. Okay, so we have a fantastic lineup of speakers, an impressive amount of expertise on the topic of pandemic preparedness here at LSE. We start with Dr. Claire Wenham, who is an associate professor of global health policy in the Department of Health Policy. She's a leading expert on pandemic policy, on health security, focusing on various areas, on the gendered impact of epidemic policy, on disease surveillance, on funding mechanism, on the role of the WTO and different other aspects, and also author of a forthcoming book called, I think, What Do We Know and What Should We Do About Pandemics? Is that right, Claire? So this will be a very important contribution to the debate. Then we have Dr. Tine Hanrieder, who is an associate professor of health international development in the LSE Department of International Development. Her research also covers different aspects of health governance, from the institutional design of the World Health Organization to an emergence of health worker roles, and also on the issue of international recruitment of health workers. We have Professor Ken Schadler next to me, who is a professor of development studies in the Department of International Development, an authority on various aspects of international property governance, but with a special interest in the implications for pharmaceutical products and health. And last but not least, we have Dr. Ulrich Sedlmayr, who is a reader in international relations in the Department of International Relations at LSE, a leading authority on the European Union, on the EU enlargement process, on democratization, rule of law, but also on international on public opinion on international cooperation. So this is, I'm very excited to hear their perspectives on the general topic. We start now with Dr. Wenner.
Claire, thank please. You, thank you, and thank you everyone for coming here. It's so great to see such a full audience for one of these events. So the question is, how do we prepare for the next global crisis? And I think what I wanted to start with is taking you back to how have we been preparing thus far? And I'm looking at this from a kind of global level, right, which is that diseases cross borders, and therefore it requires a global or transnational response that no one country is able to manage pandemics, crises of infectious disease on their own, because we know they're spread. So there's this kind of need to work collaboratively and collectively. And this isn't new. There's a piece of international law, which some of you may have come across, called the International Health Regulations, which were set up in its predecessor was set up in the mid-19th century. And it really was designed to get, at that time, city-states, but later on governments, working together to try and engage in kind of best practice protocols around quarantine, best practice protocols around cordon sanitaires in seas and shipping. And it really was trying to balance this tension that we see between trade needing to spread around the world and diseases needing to be stopped from affecting those trade routes, right? So this is where the start of international cooperation for pandemic control comes from. And this has been updated several times, the last one being in 2005, when the international health regulations were codified as a piece of international law that governments all signed up for in the wake of SARS. And again, the idea and the aim of these was to protect against and provide a public health response to the international spread of disease in ways that were commensurate with and also restricted to public health risks, and which importantly avoided unnecessary interference with travel and trade. And so governments had obligations to build surveillance systems, to build mechanisms for reporting disease to WHO, mechanisms for sharing information, clinical information about pathogens that were occurring. And indeed, we then had a responsibility to follow the guidance from the World Health Organization about what to do if one of these risks emerged. And this is where we were when COVID struck, right? Governments had signed up to it. It was a legally binding piece of law. And it didn't really work, right? Governments didn't necessarily follow all their obligations under COVID, under the international health regulations during COVID. First of all, we saw breaches of particular articles. You know, the famous one that I'm sure you all remember was the travel restrictions that many governments put on Southern African countries during the Omicron wave against WHO advice around travel restrictions. We've seen a massive gap in the IHR around things like response mechanisms and equity in response mechanisms, right? Vaccine equity being the big issue that is, you know, so apparent missing from this. And so in the wake of COVID, the kind of global health community were getting together and thinking, well, what are we going to do? You know, trying to answer this question, how are we going to get governments to act better in future? And Charles Michel at the European Council suggested, he went on stage and said, I've got the idea, guys, we're going to have a pandemic treaty and it's going to solve everything, right? We're going to get governments to behave better next time by getting them all to agree to more law and binding provisions, which will mean that they will cooperate, that they will share data, that they will share vaccines. Sounds great, right? But it was never fundamentally going to work, right? And those of you who've been following this debate will be very aware of this. But this area of governance, this area of international law, falls into this sort of tricky distinction between governments wanting to take a very securitized response to infectious disease. You know, they want to shut their borders. They want to make sure that their populations, their economies are, you know, being prioritized. Maybe understandably, you know, they have to demonstrate to their electorates that they're doing things. And that is, so you've got this kind of very national level sort of securitized response happening within many governments, particularly Western governments. very much different to the kind of broader cosmopolitan norms that we see across global health, that we see in institutions like the World Health Organization that say, no, we should all be in this together and we should all share and we should all be equitable. You know, yes, morally we should, but there's a tension between state-based decision making and kind of global norms. And yet the world jumped on this treaty, this treaty idea. Within a few weeks, we had 26 states who had agreed to go forward with it. And that then led to a special session of the World Health Assembly, which then led to the creation of the Intergovernmental Negotiating Body, which you may have heard of, the INB, who'd been working for the last 2 years to negotiate a treaty. And every kind of issue area related to pandemic preparedness and even more broader issues of health really got involved with this. They all thought this was their opportunity to get their work, their policy needs in the kind of high level of, you know, treaty policy making. But, you know, the kind of throw the kitchen sink at it approach, which happened in the early stages, was going to be problematic because this was a treaty that was going to be negotiated within 2 years, right? It was going to be finished by actually just the last World Health Assembly that happened just at the end of May. And so we had this kind of problem of volume of issue areas going into it, and also recognizing that COVID had exposed quite how many issue areas were affected by pandemics. There was also problems around the location of where this treaty was going to be negotiated and hosted. And the World Health Organization jumped on it and said, yep, we want it. We are the directing and coordinating authority for international health. It needs to sit within the World Health Organization. And that was problematic, many people argue, right? Because WHO doesn't really have much power, right? It's not like a UN Security Council. It's not like a UN General Assembly. It hasn't also got the experience of multilateral negotiations and treaty making, right? It's only done it once before in its existence with the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. So it wasn't necessarily the right location to get governments to, in future, comply with peace of law and manage a process of negotiating. But perhaps this was strategic. Perhaps government said, well, actually, we don't really want to sign up to any new piece of law. We didn't really follow the last one. We're not really going to follow this. So let's just, and again, this kind of tension between national security approaches and more cosmopolitan norms. Maybe it was strategic. They said, fine, put it in WHO. They can deal with it and we won't actually ever have to do anything. And so we've got, and we had then had tensions, and we've been watching the negotiations for the last couple of years, and there's been a number of issues. And those of you who've been following them, it's been around whether this piece of law should be legally binding or not legally binding, how you're going to get governments to actually follow it, right? How do you get governments to comply when we know they haven't complied in future? How do we get simply the process negotiated? The process has been somewhat chaotic. There's been this tension of this adage of nothing's agreed till everything's agreed. And so actually we haven't been able to see much progress happening because nothing yet is agreed. And fundamentally, governments are having to answer this question of what are you willing to give up nationally to be prepared globally, right? And this is kind of the big question that governments are going through at all these stages of negotiations. And the answer during COVID really was not that much, right? We don't really want to give up that much. And what we've seen during the negotiation process is exactly the same, right? The key kind of fundamental, I'm sure Ken and Ulrich will talk about this, you know, the key issue that remains as the negotiations go on is this question around vaccine equity, right? How do we make sure that those who need countermeasures in future are able to get them regardless of their location? How do we stop hoarding by rich countries? And governments simply aren't on the same page on this, right? We have two big blocks that are on very different pages around what they're willing to agree to. And so it's got to this really difficult question of, like, how do we now take it forward? For those of you who aren't aware, 2 weeks ago, they didn't manage to negotiate and agree the treaty. They've decided to give it another year, and they've now put the deadline for this time next May. But I can't see how we're going to change this in a year, right? I think personally, and this is my opinion, that, you know, we're going to be having the same conversation next year, which is, again, we haven't agreed a treaty. And treaties take a long time. You know, the international lawyers in the room will know that these things take decades to negotiate. And the political landscape at the moment just simply isn't there. You know, if you think half the world are going to the polls this year, no one wants to hear the word pandemic. No one wants to hear the word vaccines, right? People are, the general electorate are bored of it. So there's no real mandate. There's no real kind of political mandate to take this forward. So I'm going to leave it there because I'm aware I'm out of time, but I hope the conversation will continue.
Thank you very much, Claire. Tina.
Okay. So much in there, but I will talk about another area where international cooperation also is not great, because in recent years I did research on health workforce and the strengthening of health workers and the migration of health workers, which is also overseen by WHO, not only. So one could say this is one of the pillars of health system strengthening, that countries should support their health workforce also under the international health regulations. And I noted that in that pandemic treaty that Claire says might never happen, Article 7 is dedicated to strengthening health workers as well. And there is, for example, this formulation, minimize the negative effect of health worker migration on health systems. You have all seen, and we are all aware, that the COVID pandemic brought to light and drew attention to the plights of health workers, the scarcity of health workers, the resignation of health workers, the pain at the front line, the ways in which health workers were not protected, were sacrificed in the name of pandemic safety, called essential workers. And so they make it into more international discussions, including the pandemic treaty. But they are also scarce and they are poorly supported. And this is not changing, just like attention to the pandemic is waning. So one of the basic observations to start with is that creating good enough jobs for health workers is a challenge for all countries, for rich countries and for poor countries. But rich countries have the advantage that they can attract workers from poorer countries and solve their health workforce needs to some extent by immigration and by international recruitment. I just say a few figures. So WHO estimates that by 2030, 10 million health personnel will be lacking. Estimates vary, others are higher. WHO also estimates through various measures that the increase of health worker inflow to high-income countries has happened through the pandemic. So with the pandemic, where you thought borders were shut, a lot of countries poached more intensively, a lot of health workers sought to migrate more actively than before. So one speaks of about a 31% increase of inflow of doctors into OECD countries and 36% increase of inflow of nurses into OECD countries. Not all of this is brain drain, but a lot of it is. So recently we had the chance with funding from the LSE Stickart Centers and with Leon Janauszek, who is now at LSE Health, to look a bit more closely at how countries manage this migration of health workers and try to mitigate this impact, as also the pandemic treaty says. And being German, and Germany being one of those countries having gotten super active in this and trying to fill its health workforce needs with recruitment of workers, we looked at how Germany does it. It's one of those countries, the UK also has a code of practice that is praised internationally for doing it well, for being an ethical recruiter of international health workers through different regulations and a certificate for the private sector and bilateral agreements. Two main observations from this. One is that current efforts at managing health worker migration fairly fail developing countries' health systems. So managing this migration should be done and is done to a huge extent through bilateral agreements. Mm-hmm. That's also what WHO recommends, that countries have trade agreements, but also labor agreements, to make sure that countries do not suffer too much the loss of the health workers, but also that the workers are protected. And we looked in more depth at what Germany does around those bilateral agreements. And yeah, there is some improvement. There are good things happening when you look at, there is more safety and transparency for the people who make the move if they have an agreement in their back. But everything else that those agreements also should do and that WHO keeps emphasizing, like compensating the countries for loss of their health workers or practicing what I call it now due diligence for health systems of the countries of origin. Is there a good health labor market analysis? do we talk to health sector stakeholders before we make the agreement, and not only with the Ministry of Labour? None of this happens. So the right partners are not engaged. Care is not taken of what happens to the few nurses left behind in an understaffed hospital or to the unstaffed rural hospital. What happens to the demand by a partner country, say Mexico, for support with health infrastructure? Nothing. It's declined. So there are no compensations in place, and all the developmental side of these managed migration pathways is absent. And if you look at recent policy reports by WHO giving overviews how other countries do it, this is not an exception. It generally fails. Those bilateral avenues of handling health worker migration do not mitigate brain drain. And then the second point I want to make is that privatization does not help. For Germany, it's the case that even though there is the government there with its bilateral deals and other countries the same, a lot is happening through the private industry for recruitment. So you have a lot of private agencies going and finding the workers, but also the health systems of the origin countries are hampered by privatized production of health workers, employment of health workers, and public-private partnerships mitigating the impact of migration. You can see that if a private recruitment agency makes the deal and gets the worker, it has no market incentive and no business model to give a compensation or to create a job in India. That's just that's not working, and that's also why no one wants to give the resources and no one wants to support such a business model. And that's why you also trim it down to private sustainable recruitment. But there's also this privatized training of health workers. Let's say the Philippines. A lot of training of nurses in the Philippines go through private colleges. You pay loans for that. The colleges train for very volatile international labor markets. So what's on demand in Germany? What's on demand in the US? Train to emigrate, train to pay back your loans. This reliance on private sector, again, undermines the health ministry's efforts to somehow provide its country with health workers. And even though the Philippines also promote migration to stay with that country, 1.5 years ago, the health minister said, we lack 100,000 nurses for our own country. So there's something like a big mismatch between public planning capacity and health workforce management and reliance on different private services. Let me also mention India, because the Indian state of Kerala got off the so-called red list of countries you cannot recruit from recently. It was one of the reasons why Germany ventured into India. And one notable thing for India is that the WHO Office of India wrote a report about the state of nursing in India and the country lacking nurses, but nevertheless recommending that in nurse education and training, you build into the education and training the learning of foreign languages. Because the job opportunities for nurses in India and specifically the private sector are just not recommendable. So you are left with that option, support the workers and not find a solution for supporting the health system. Last remark on privatization. I've also shown in other work how WHO itself relies to a huge extent on private project money and on private expertise and consultants, and the capacity of that organization is also dwindling on due to private sector reliance. Oxfam has recently published a report that a lot of development aid goes into for-profit hospitals that are not accessible to the poor. And I think as long as we don't have better management of international cooperation in the health workforce domain and better public resources and stewardship for managing health systems and health workforce, institutions will fail women who are mostly health workers, and we will fail the next pandemic as well.
Thank you very much, Tina. Ken.
Should I use this one? Yeah? Ooh, I'm double mic'd. All right, so everybody can hear me all over the universe. Thanks, Raul, for being here, and for the organizers for including me and those online. So, I mean, the title is How Can We Prepare, How Countries Can Prepare, and of course, I think how to prepare depends on, the answer to that question depends on what you think are the things that went wrong in the last one, and I suspect that 100 people have 100 different diagnoses and then 100 different things they suggest. Since I do, as Matthias said when he introduced me, I tend to work on pharmaceutical issues. I'm going to focus on where I think things went wrong in the last pandemic in the area of drugs and vaccines. And that's principally, Clara mentioned the inequity in the distribution of vaccines, which I think is right. And at the core of that is sort of an overly concentrated production. And what I mean by that is, first of all, we should be amazed that in the year 2021, the world produced about 11 billion doses of COVID-19 vaccines. That's pretty amazing, given that the usual output in the entire world for vaccines in any given year, for any type of vaccines given to kids or adults or whatever, is about 4 billion doses. And so we produce almost three times as many doses of a new vaccine without minimizing the other production either in a year. It's amazing, but it was all done in the same places. So almost all the production was either in the US, Europe, China, and India, which are four countries. It's also four countries that account for about half of the global population. And there's 11 billion doses, but most vaccines require two, some three doses. And you could see there's this scarcity. That's a different problem than we normally have in pharmaceuticals. Usually the problem in pharmaceuticals is not that there aren't enough, but that the ones that are there are too expensive, and they're not expensive because they're scarce. They're expensive because there are other barriers to them. In this, the problem isn't that they were too expensive, because most vaccines were going to be sold at a fairly low price, especially in poorer countries. The problem is that there just weren't enough, and there weren't enough close to the places where they needed to be used. So it was too easy for countries where they're producing them to say, we're going to keep those all for ourselves. So, and for therapeutics, the concentration of production is even more so, but I'm going to focus mostly on vaccines. Why? It's because the companies that were making the vaccines were very reluctant to transfer the technology widely to lots of partners. So most vaccines were produced in one or two or three sites for the whole world. The exception to this, and it's an exception that's worth emphasizing, is the vaccine that was developed in the laboratories at Oxford that was then transferred to AstraZeneca, which then set up production networks in 12 different parts of the world. So it sort of stands off. Like every other vaccine, the main production is in one, two, or three sites, and this one is in 12. There's all of them, and there's that one. Now, that's really difficult. It's really difficult to pull that off. Technology transfer simultaneously to 12 different partners, more if you include sort of the more downstream parts of production. I'm just talking about making the main part of the vaccine itself. And I should say, when I say global, a lot of the production was in the countries you would expect, but there was also AstraZeneca had partners in India, Thailand, and in South America, in Brazil and Argentina. But it was difficult, and really of all the production that they set up, the one that was the most successful and the only one that really sort of ran almost, you'd say, swimmingly without problems, was the production in India, which created a problem when the Indian government decided in May of 2021 that because of the Delta variant in India, they were going to basically keep the vaccines and prevent the company from exporting them. So when we say how can we fix this problem going forward, how can we do better? I think the question that we have to ask ourselves is how can we sort of get to more distributed, less concentrated production of vaccines for the next pandemic? Well, one way to do that is for more companies and more countries around the world to be producing their own vaccines. It's amazing that we had so many successful vaccines, but maybe if we had more sort of local development of vaccines, new products, that is difficult. It's not like virtually every country, every scientist in every country wasn't trying to produce a COVID-19 vaccine. It's just a very difficult, costly process. And the ones that succeeded are the ones that got a lot of external support. But there are sort of things to get excited about. There's a collaboration among developing countries coordinated by the WHO, in which a set of countries based in South Africa and also based in Brazil are essentially trying to create their own version of an mRNA vaccine that's modeled after the Moderna vaccine. Now, nobody's going to ever want this vaccine. There's no need for it because the Moderna vaccine will be out there. So they're not actually trying to create their own version of the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine. They're trying to use that as a way to basically create to show that they can create their own version of a mRNA vaccine that they're calling sort of pathogen agnostic, and that when the time comes, they can have like a leg up to begin producing whatever the next sort of whatever the next vaccine would be, depending on what that pathogen is for the crisis that's around the corner that we don't know about. Of course, there's a huge number of questions here about, you know, there are some intellectual property issues with what aspects of the platform Moderna owns of this, which could get in the way. It's also mRNA is still a very unproven technology. We still have exactly one approved product, maybe two, I think, because I think Moderna is about to get something else approved. But sort of like there is a lot invested in the fact that, oh, this is the way forward. These are big questions that have to be addressed. But that's sort of, I think, something that's an encouraging thing to think about. Encouraging more technology transfer from sort of the originator firms in the US and Europe, principally to partners around the globe. So more of what we had very little of the last time. That's just what there's been a lot of talk about this. And as Claire said, this is what a lot of the discussions in the WHO for the pandemic treaty have been about. I'm even more skeptical than Claire is that you can ever read that this would we have an agreement on this, treaty. Even if you did have an agreement on this treaty, I'm very skeptical that you could actually have sort of binding rules on mandatory transfer of technology. I just don't think that's the way technology transfer works. But I do think that it's sort of a disappointing that we don't really have even an agreement on targets. Like I would have been more than happy, not everybody would be, but I would have been more than happy with a really watered down treaty that basically said like, this is a goal, this is an aspiration. And we basically want countries to at least report what they're doing, what they're trying to do, what their aims are, what resources they're putting sort of towards the end of technology transfer, even if they're not committing themselves to mandatorily transferring technology. I would have been happy with something a lot more modest like that, but for reasons that Claire has talked about, we couldn't even get to that, which is disappointing. I would say that might be an agreement that a lot of people who are pushing really hard for the treaty wouldn't have liked, but I would have been happy with that. We could also use a lot more incentives to get the originators to transfer their technology, because the way we dealt with it in the pandemic was essentially we just told the originators, go ahead and do it. There were a lot of incentives for originators to transfer technology to produce production internally. The UK did a lot of that. The US did a lot of that. The Europeans did a lot of that. But none of these incentives were for originators to transfer their technology to expand production globally. That happened when the originators wanted it to happen. So as far as we understand, AstraZeneca did it. Nobody else did it, as I said before, because Oxford required them to do it as a condition of the license. But if you didn't want to do that, Moderna didn't want to do it, Johnson & Johnson didn't want to do that, Pfizer didn't want to do that, you didn't do it. More incentives to get them to do that could have been very helpful. And again, I think targets of this sort could have been included in a treaty and would be the sorts of things that shouldn't be that difficult to agree upon unless you're just sort of stuck in and saying, we don't want to agree on anything at the international level. Do I have one more minute or should one I wrap minute. Up? Yeah. So the last thing I would say is what can countries prepare for the next global health crisis? And we tend to think of, we've been talking about this as countries as the global community, but lots of individual countries are basically trying to prepare by investing massively in developing their own local pharmaceutical production capabilities. And there's hardly a country in the world that isn't doing something about this now, not to mention every regional organization in the world, in Africa, in Asia, and in Latin America. A lot of the proposals out there lack concreteness. They're more about they're more aspirational than they are saying what they're actually going to do. And there's a huge gap in coordination, and that basically not every country in the world can produce the same sets of products, and there's a reason why they should. And it seems like there's a lot of them are basically replicating what the neighboring country is doing. I do know that the G20 is being hosted by Brazil, and they've set up for November, and they've set up a specific project to try to coordinate the infinite number of global efforts that are going on towards increasing local and regional production capabilities.
So we'll have to see what happens in the next 6 months. But it makes me think I'm not the only person that's watching this and saying, we don't need 50 different initiatives. We need maybe two or three.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thanks, and thanks for everybody for coming to the event. So what I wanted to talk about is a narrow aspect of something that Kenneth touched upon, which is about vaccination, but it's about international cooperation on vaccination, especially production and distribution of vaccines. But what I'm interested in, or what research that I've been involved in has been asking, is what does the public think about it? Is there public support for international cooperation, especially in high-income countries? Because that's where it's crucial. It's not surprising that in low-income countries, of course, the public would be in favor, but it's in the high-income countries where it's more problematic. And we've been surprised to think there's actually very little research into public opinion. You know, as Claire has said, governments, you know, sort of do care about public opinion. They want to be seen by their electorates to be doing something with the pandemic. But they don't really seem to sort of look into what the public really thinks. And maybe to give away the punchline of our research, so what we found is actually there is maybe surprisingly high support for international cooperation, but it's also fragile. And that's what I want to disentangle a little bit. But before I get into that, I should probably also answer the question, how does it relate to the theme, how countries can prepare for the next pandemic? And here the point would be partly given that there is actually public support in high-income countries for international cooperation. I think it's important for governments to be aware of that and to use that knowledge, to know that the public would be actually, yeah, sort of not punishing them if they were to cooperate. And the other point is also that governments need to know sort of if they were to choose to cooperate. And I think we've heard the arguments why international cooperation in the pandemic is crucial or is important for a better outcome, what they can do in order to increase public support or to reduce opposition to it. So our research has been looking at, in the last pandemic, in COVID-19, sort of what the public thought specifically in the UK about cooperation in COVAX. So COVAX has been the main multilateral institutions where countries have been, on a voluntary basis, coordinating to make vaccines available all over the world. And essentially, the idea was that with regards to the production of vaccines, that countries would not go directly to manufacturers, make advance contracts, which is essentially what all of the high-income countries did in the end, but that they would go through COVAX, who would then invest in a broader portfolio, which would be more efficient. There's less of a risk that you back, you know, the wrong horse. But also that then afterwards, when it comes to the distribution of vaccines, that all countries would first only get 20% enough vaccines to vaccinate the most vulnerable 20% of their population. And only once all countries in the world have enough vaccines to vaccinate the most vulnerable parts of the population, then countries that do want to can purchase more vaccines. So it was done on a voluntary basis. The high-income countries did donate some vaccines. They gave some money, but essentially went for the unilateral options. They went for advance contracts, went to vaccinate their own population fully and twice over, usually before they were supporting COVAX. So what we were asking was essentially sort of whether respondents in the UK, with a survey of about 4,000 respondents, whether they favored the UK government to prioritize cooperation in COVAX over essentially acting unilaterally advance contracts with manufacturers. And the result was that there was actually quite surprisingly high support. So, you know, sort of when you include the don't knows and those who don't think that vaccination is a good strategy anyway, then the support was 51%, while 29% were opposed to the multilateral cooperative effort. And if you then eliminate the don't know, so the support goes up to 63%. So it's actually quite high. And there, I know at least one other study that has looked into public opinion in other high-income countries as well, and that's about donations of vaccines. And there have been similar high support. But we weren't quite satisfied just with, yeah, does the public support it, but also how stable is that support? Can it be swayed either positively or negatively? Yeah, can information campaigns, sort of why cooperation is good, can they help to increase support? Or, yeah, conversely, yeah, sort of we probably can be sure that sort of, yeah, if there was more cooperation, there'd be nationalist, populist mobilization. Sort of, why do we give vaccines or enable, you know, poorer countries to have vaccines before we have vaccinated everybody in our own national community? So to what extent that kind of national vaccine nationalism discourse can sway public opinion negatively, decrease support. So what we did was an experiment where we contrast the control group that just information what COVAX does, and then ask people whether they supported it or not. And then experimental groups that either sort of were given information about the benefits of a cooperative approach, the benefits of COVAX, and another group, which is essentially kind of the rhetoric of vaccine nationalism, why that is better for the national community. And then we had one group that got both of those sort of more balanced information. And essentially what we found is that exposure to the vaccine nationalism frame, to those information cues, significantly decreases support. So what I have the numbers here. So it decreases it by about, I think about 15 percentage points. If individuals get both frames, both negative and positive information, it also increases, but less so, about 10 percentage points. However, if individuals get the positive information, the benefit of course, it doesn't really increase. So it has no discernible impact. How can we explain that? That's one question. And what does it mean in terms of policy implications? You know, if either governments or other advocacy groups want to increase support, what can they do? How can we explain it that there's this uneven effect? The effect of sort of why the more nationalist message does actually work in terms of increasing support. So that is explained part of it. There's literature how in crises there is a kind of a in-group bias that you sort of care more about the national community over those who are further away. Also, it leads to more short-term solutions. Sort of you care more about the short-term rather than sort of thinking about long-term solutions like to the pandemic by sort of vaccinating everywhere rather than just in one country. So that's one effect. But why does it not really work to increase support when you get the kind of the positive information? Partly what we might be seeing there is a ceiling effect, that the initial support was already quite high. So it's actually difficult to increase it further. And then that also asks questions, so why was it so high? And there might be also sort of some factors in there, the timing of the survey, it was done before vaccines actually became available. And if it's sort of more potential, then you might be more willing to say, oh yeah, we'll share, than when it's actually there. Although sort of some later, the other survey was slightly later when the vaccines were out there. It was also done during the time when the handling of the government of the pandemic had very low public support. So probably it seemed a safer bet or sort of less scary to go for international institutions rather than trust the national government. But what does that mean in terms of policy implications? If public information campaigns can't really increase support, does that mean that we should just give up on kind of educating the public? That's not the case, because here it's important to see that if we have both information cues, the positive and the negative frames, that actually the support doesn't decrease by as much. And what we can probably assume is there will always be the kind of the frame, the kind of the nationalist populist countermeasures. They will always be out there, but it helps to reduce the negative impact if individuals also have the positive message out there emphasizing the benefits of cooperation. How much more time do I have, Matthias?
30 seconds.
Okay. Then I'm going to skip the rest of the very interesting research that we've done and just leave it there. Thanks, Matthias.
Thank you very much. Okay, so in the interest of giving several people the opportunity to ask questions, please be concise, whether you are writing the question in the chat or whether you are here in the room. And if you want to target them to a specific member of the panel, please do so. Otherwise, you know, maybe one of them might be picked up. Okay, so raise your hand if you'd like to ask a question. Okay, can I have this person in the second row? Yes.
You could argue that the next pandemic is already here, because measles is on the increase across the world within the UK. I'd like to know why the panel think that is.
Okay, I'm getting a second. Maybe I grouped the fourth row. Yes, exactly. Thank you.
You've all talked about the international response, but you haven't talked about the sort of personal interaction of humans. And I guess the sort of question I have is, in Europe and in the United States, there was a large segment of the public that was not convinced of the potential dangers of the pandemic, which kind of represents a failure in the sort of public health information sphere. How can that be improved? I mean, in the US and in the UK, we both had leaders at the time that clearly did not believe in it and, you know, were hospitalized because of it. How can we create, you know, government institutions to make sure that governments take it seriously, to get the public to take it seriously?
Can you also please tell your name when you ask a question in the next round? Yes. Who'd like to pick up those questions?
Start?
Yeah, Claire.
Sure. Yes, thank you for your questions. I mean, measles, lots of other diseases which are, you know, have been traditionally childhood diseases, which have been mostly kind of not been a big public health risk, are coming back for multiple reasons, you know, because of low vaccination rates, because of low trust in vaccines and science, because of different immigration patterns and different vaccination histories in different countries. There's multiple different reasons for these. And that's not the only one, right? I mean, there's lots of these things. And that's why it's so important to this question, right, which is how do you get the trust back in science, right, and kind of evidence-based science. And there's lots of really interesting research happening, you know, with colleagues at LSHTM, colleagues in Georgetown that are doing loads of really interesting work around how to kind of gain confidence back, right? And the problem is that there's not one answer, because there's whole different reasons why people may or may not trust in both government institutions giving evidence, scientific methods, and there's a whole range of reasons, you know. It's so it's hard to then create policies which try and address all of those, right? And it's a very gray scale, right? You might, you know, believe in science, but not believe in this, or not trust this one thing because so-and-so said it, right? So there's a whole bigger picture there. And I certainly am not qualified to answer it, but I think it's a really, it's key and it's fundamental, right? And how, and you know, what, and you know, it's, and it's not just about pandemics, right? Like, how do you improve broader scientific literacy across populations and issues that, you know, AI, I mean, there's lots of different things that this all needs to be kind of packaged in.
I can't say much on your question, but maybe just on yours. I mean, I think that's another interesting question. I mean, I'm interested in the attitude towards international cooperation. I think your point is a more, even more basic one, how you get people to take it seriously. And I would think, I mean, then the interesting question is, if people take it less seriously, is it actually better for international cooperation? Yeah, if it's less politicized, people don't take it as seriously, are they more willing to say, okay, we cooperate on that? So it might be, ironically, it might be counterproductive. Although, and that's the other part in there. There's so many different arguments that you can make. You know, Claire and Ken talk about the equity argument. In our, so we actually sort of kept that out, the kind of more sort of the normative obligation to also care about others, but more the sort of the self-interested one, that you should actually care about whether people else will get vaccinated, because you're not going to fight it in your country alone. So I think there's different levels of people taking it seriously and what kind of arguments that would lead them to either take it seriously and then also to take it seriously to the point that they realize, understand, agree that international cooperation is the only way to fight it effectively.
I would like to take a question from the online participants, in particular one from Anthony Vanion. So he says, what are the two blocks Claire mentioned on the treaty, but then has this information about effects on US sovereignty played a role in the failure so far? So I think perhaps we could even broaden up this question, so not so much about disinformation about sovereignty in the US per se, but also the general trend towards you know, the strengthening of political parties and ideologies for which, you know, giving up sovereignty is more of a problem increasingly. Is there any views on that in the panel?
Yeah. I don't want to, if these guys want to go, I don't want to.
Maybe we'll see if somebody has a question specifically for Ken and Tina.
I mean, so the issue with the sovereignty, so, you know, the two blocks that we have, effectively, you have a kind of, well, they call themselves a group of equity, kind of low income countries from around the world who all share the position around access, access and benefit sharing, and sharing of, you know, tech transfer, vaccine access through a range of mediums. And then the countries mainly where pharmaceutical production is based, you know, US, UK, Europe, EU, that don't want to have, you know, equity because it's not in their interest to do that in the same way, with big lobbies from the pharmaceutical sector as well. And this question of sovereignty is really interesting because it's not just the US, right? We've seen buses down in Geneva, you know, with big Stop the Pandemic Treaty. In the UK, we have Farage and Suella Braverman talking about sort of the pandemic treaty is going to block our sovereignty. And it's just not, right? It's just a catcall to the right wing, because actually, if any of them have read the treaty text, it would show you very clearly that there's absolutely no way that the WHO is going to have any power to force a lockdown, to force a vaccine on you, right? It's simply not there. And the first principle in the pandemic treaty text as it stands is sovereignty of nations, right? Sovereignty of decision making, sovereignty whether you want to sign up to it in the first place. It's just that it's kind of, it's part of this broader right wing populist narrative of kind of, you know, get every international organization, any institution out of national policymaking. And it's having an effect, right? It's starting to shift positions. I mean, the UK government started to shift its position, in my opinion, you know, to try and appeal to that right wing of the UK as we come up to election time. So it really matters in terms of if a negotiation is going to happen, this right wing has to be engaged with. But fundamentally, it's a sideshow because it's actually not part of the treaty text in and of itself.
Okay, thanks. So if there are no additions, I would like to ask if there are questions specifically on the question of health workers for Dr. Hanrieder or intellectual property for Professor Scharnen. Yes, here, please.
Yeah, thank you very much. Ewan Grant, I'm a former law enforcement intelligence analyst. So much of my work is developing ideas and prediction. And on that, the safety of health workers, which organizations do you have faith in to properly investigate the proper treatment of migration of workers and their employment when they are engaged in the OECD countries? The reason I say that is the sorry, very, very sorry saga of EU Frontex, and I believe there's not enough scepticism about the effectiveness of pan-national bodies about keeping an eye on this. It's a very, very real problem. So I'd just be interested. I would strongly urge you to look at the sorry saga of EU Frontex. Thank you very much.
And I would take, if it's relevant to the two topics, also someone at the back. No? Okay.
It was more about the coordination.
Okay, let's maybe come later. So didn't you have any response to that question?
I mean, EU Frontex, that's not the legal migration pathway that you get on when you manage to be recruited as a desired or skilled health worker. So in the field that we look at, where you come because you're profession is recognized, you get a temporary visa or a durable visa, it would be work safety bodies and ILO standards that apply to you. So you're already in a much better place and you still keep having a lot of problems. Yeah, right. So de-skilling, exploitation, working below your qualification. No support paying back remittances, but it's a different kind of avenue.
I'm sorry, we have to move on because there are other people who like to ask questions, maybe at the very back. Maybe we take two together. Yes, please.
Thank you. Just about the treaty and about coordination generally, I guess this is for everyone. Coordination was mentioned and all the different points about human resources, about pharmaceutical, about cross-border collaboration. In EU last year, it was approved already a new article in the by the European Parliament about the cross-border collaboration, the joint procurement of medications and so forth. But the challenge was that although there is willingness among policymakers, is how to do it and the capacity to actually coordinate. And we all know that there is a big difference between wanting to collaborate and being able to coordinate and having the capacities to do that. How do you see it happening in place, even if in case of having a treaty and all countries, there are a lot of treaties there that try to encourage collaboration on many other areas. How do you see actual coordination happening and this, how to make a system that allow that in first place?
Okay, and next, yes.
Hi, my name is Ajay. I'm from the Media Communications Department. It's just an equity question that there were two things that were spoken about. So one was two resources within the health sector. So one was the nurses specifically from India when you're talking about that. And then we're talking about vaccines. And I don't find it to be contrasting, but then just to put it in perspective from what I understand, when you're speaking about the nurses, we're talking about how there are a lot of nurses from India and many other countries that are going to migrating for the sake of higher pay, probably higher standards of living. And there was a case made for why these countries, Philippines and India, should equip themselves to have higher number of nurses within themselves. But then when we speak of vaccines, it was a different perspective that was spoken about. We are talking about when there's a minimum requirement around the world, it is not for, again, India to keep the vaccines for themselves, but then to make sure that the rest of the world, you meet the minimum required, the 20% everywhere, and then look at increasing the vaccine cover within India. So I understand vaccine is a whole other ballgame when you're talking about nurses. This is a very critical situation. But then where do we bridge the gap when it comes to equity in terms of different resources that way?
And then finally, I have a question from an online participant. What is the role of AMCs as a mechanism for developing vaccines and other technology transfers? So this is from Ipsita Parida, who is a physician. So maybe we start with this last question. Ken, would you like to say anything about that?
Yeah, so the AMCs and the questions are advanced market commitments. And we saw a lot of those in the pandemic. Whenever you read in the papers that the European Union or the UK government or the US government or any government was buying, Garrett saying they were going to buy vaccines if they were approved, that was an advanced market commitment. And typically those are regarded as an instrument for like incentivizing innovation where there is for products where there isn't much of a market. So we're going to create that market to guarantee that it's worth your investment. Advanced market commitments in the pandemic, I don't really think were what incentivize the innovation, because everybody knew there was a market. I think it was more about getting your place in the queue. But where they could contribute more to equities if they were bigger. And that's kind of what I was sort of speaking at. Like when I said there were lots of incentives for technology transfer during the pandemic, but they were all local, that's what I was talking about. I just didn't use the term advanced market commitments. But if they had been really big, so then the companies would have had to produce a lot more, then they would have been sort of almost compelled or greatly incentivized to search partners and transfer their technology. So the answer, so my response to that question is that AMCs, advanced market commitments, can be really good and really useful, but they should be sufficiently large to make technology transfer part of the story.
Then we have two questions, one on coordination and one on equity. Is there anyone on the panel who would like to pick them up?
Yeah. I can try the equity one. That was such a nice comparison. Mm-hmm. One could play with it forever, right? Comparing vaccines to workers. And it's also, yeah, maybe dangerous, but interesting. I would like to think about it in terms of fair trade, if you may. I mean, it does happen all the time that a country or a production place has a competitive advantage in something. I mean, Cuba produces pharmaceuticals and tries to earn money with it and export it. So I think trade happens, migration happens, and the perspective is more, are the health needs of everybody served through that trade? And is care taken of that being possible and happening without violating the rights of workers or, yeah, displacing production? So I think the comparison is actually a quite fair one.
Okay, thank you very much. Claire, you said something already about the role of the WHO, but do you want to add something from the point of view of it as a coordination agent?
That coordination question is really interesting because, I mean, effectively, the treaty, the international health regulations are the you know, like the EU ones you're talking about, you know, they're designed, they're set up to basically provide guidance, right, and provide guidelines, so how everyone is going to play by the same rules and coordinate. But it's really difficult, right, because there's so many different stakes and interests at place. And I think, you know, there's some really interesting research over the kind of the first decade of the international health regulations post their revision in 2005, showing that for the most part, states did do it, right? They saw the benefit of it and they saw that there was value to be gained from cooperating, right, and from working with partners. And whether that was, you know, surveillance information or, you know, enhanced understanding of what other people were doing and learning best practices, there's multiple different reasons. And, you know, there's a whole IR literature around why governments cooperate in general. But what we've seen is then kind of at a time of crisis, it crumples, right? And so this is the hard part, is that for something which is related to crisis, how do you get that to continue? And I don't think that's been figured out yet, right? I think that's kind of what everyone or lots of people are working on at the moment, trying to, they kind of, people use the word trust and fostering trust. And, you know, it's all quite vague, but it's because no one really knows, and no one's really figured out a way of getting it to happen yet, right? And getting that coordination to continue during a time of crisis, right? Because even in institutions like the EU, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't exactly all rosy here either, right? So there's a lot of issues and I don't think anyone's figured it out.
Thanks. Unfortunately, our time is up. If you'd like more insightful analysis, remember the C Global Health Initiative, go on the website, sign up for the mailing list, and you will receive news about research done at LSC. And finally, please join me in thanking the wonderful speakers for our
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.